Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayat and Hanna Kuonut. In this series, you will hear from leading experts offering their take on what needs to be done to promote climate foreign policy and provide you with the context you need to understand climate diplomacy today. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow us on Twitter under Climate Diplo.
In this episode, we will speak about climate fragility risks in Afghanistan together with Ollie Brown. Ollie is Associate Fellow with the London-based think tank Chatham House and member of the Climate Security Expert Network. Next to many other publications, he is the author of the Climate Fragility Risk Brief on Afghanistan, about which we will speak today. Before we start, we would like to apologize for any small audio disruptions due to remote recording. Welcome, Ollie.
Thanks. Happy to be with you.
For starters, could you please tell us a little about Afghanistan? How many people are living there? What does the country look like?
Well, I mean, it's a beautiful country. It's an amazing country with an amazing, resilient, tough population. Very mountainous, very extreme climate. It has roughly two-thirds of its land area is covered by mountains, and a quarter of the country is above 2,500 meters of sea level. And the climate across the country is pretty fierce. It goes from minus 40 in winter to plus 50 in summer. So it's a tough place to be with a tough population. Population of 37 million people. Half of them are 14 or younger, and they're very diverse ethnically, linguistically. 40 different languages, and people speak up to 200 dialects. And it has a sectarian split. So part of the population is Sunni Muslim, part of the population is Shia. It's obviously been the focus of a lot of world attention ever since 9/11 and the invasion. And now it's slipping out of the headlines and facing a drawdown in international troops. The last troops are due to leave, in theory, in May, but also falling out of the international headlines. So there's a real question now as to what happens next for Afghanistan.
So, Ali, what would you say are the main drivers of insecurity in Afghanistan?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, look, we're talking about climate change and security, but it's really important to sort of say up front that there's lots of different things that are affecting security in Afghanistan. As we were saying just now, the country's had 40 years of near constant conflict, and it has a concentrated, effectively, sort of civil war with multiple insurgent groups, and the Taliban being the best known. But, you know, there are attacks, roadblocks, the Taliban are controlling two-thirds of territory, and there's also a lot of involvement from neighbours to Afghanistan in its affairs. So there are a lot of security challenges facing Afghanistan in terms of armed insurgent attacks, the international forces that are there, the ability of the government to respond to those security threats. And what we're talking about today is about maybe some of the ways in which climate change adds and exacerbates those threats. But certainly at the moment, it's important to sort of say that climate change isn't the main driver of insecurity in Afghanistan, because there are an awful lot of different threats that are facing Afghanistan at the moment.
Thanks, Ollie. For the past four decades, Afghanistan has been suffering from the devastating impacts of constant armed conflict. What can you tell us about people's daily lives and livelihoods, and what are the different actors on the ground?
That's a big question. I mean, Afghanistan has been suffering, like you're saying, from more than 40 years of war. In several stages, the coup, the Russian invasion, the growth of the Mujahideen, the emergence of the Taliban, and then the post 9/11 international invasion that expelled the Taliban from power and is now sort of winding down. The war since 2001 has killed nearly 160,000 people, almost 50,000 of those civilians. And Afghanistan is really an example of how war damages development. It's development in reverse. Before the first coup in the end of the 70s, Afghanistan's per capita GDP was higher than a lot of its neighbors, than India and Nepal, Bhutan, 50% higher than China. But now, after 40 years of war, Afghanistan's lagging far behind these countries. And China's per capita GDP, for example, is 18 times higher than Afghanistan. So it's had a massive impact on opportunities, on people's lives, on human security, on personal security. And people's daily lives are really difficult. You know, the majority of the population lives in rural areas, poor services, high maternal infant mortality, ongoing ethnic tensions, deeply unequal society between urban and rural areas, between men and women, between different ethnic groups. It's a very difficult country in which to be a woman. And ever since the international invasion, the Taliban were kicked out of power and have slowly been taking back control, expanding across the countryside. They now have an influence in something like 2/3 of the area, and they can really, you know, attack in many places. And that's what's happening now. There's been, for the last few months, there's been a targeted assassination campaign of urban elites, those who've done quite well out of the system in the last, you know, 15, 20 years or so. Hundreds of people have been killed. It's a sort of a terror campaign that is about showing their power, showing their ability to reach different people and showing that nobody is untouchable. So Afghanistan is a difficult place to be.
And in your opinion, why is Afghanistan so vulnerable to climate change?
I mean, Afghanistan is vulnerable to climate change for two reasons. It's geography and its history. I mean, geography, as we talked about already, it's a very mountainous area. It doesn't have much in the way of very fertile land. There's little arable land, and the majority of the land that is usable for sort of agriculture or livestock herding is kind of grass-fed rangelands. You know, water is spread very unevenly across the five big watersheds across the country. And the country is very prone to natural disasters. So floods, droughts, avalanches, landslides. So that's the geography. And then there's the history. I mean, as we were saying, you know, the 40 years of conflict have left Afghanistan a long way behind its neighbors. And it's had a whole series of legacies and caused a whole series of impacts that Afghanistan is dealing with now. So deforestation, increased in mistrust between groups, the destruction of water resources, the loss of old traditional ways of managing both land and water. You know, four decades of underinvestment in infrastructure, like mechanisms to store water and use it. And then high levels of poverty, which means that a lot of Afghans are living in a really vulnerable position. Their levels of poverty are higher than 50%. So people live a real sort of hand-to-mouth existence without many resources to fall back on. And if they are hit by a climate shock or a drought or a flood, it's difficult for them to be resilient to it and difficult for the government also to support them in recovering after it.
Thank you. Now let's get into how these dynamics affect security. So in your climate fragility risk brief, you identified five pathways to which climate change threatens long-term peace and stability in the country. The first one addresses climate shocks and headwinds. So what are headwinds and what impacts do they have on the country?
Yeah, this really refers to just the cumulative impacts of climate change in Afghanistan. This is not something that's going to be happening in future. This is happening already. I mean, since, you know, 1950, the mean annual temperatures have risen. The snowpack is melting earlier. There are, you know, heavy rainfall events have increased by as much as a quarter. Droughts are increasingly common. And spring rainfall in the highlands, which is what sort of feeds the rivers that flow across Afghanistan, are down significantly. And when we look ahead, what happens to Afghanistan sort of depends on what we collectively as a global community decide to do about climate change. But in the best case scenario, we're looking at 1.5 degrees warming by 2050 and 2.5 degrees by the end of the century. But in a business as usual scenario, we're talking about potentially 3 degrees warming because Afghanistan, as a landlocked high area, is warming faster than the global average, and potentially up to 7 degrees of warming by the end of the century. And this could have a whole series of impacts on agriculture in terms of what crops you can grow, how likely your crops are to survive, in terms of health, in terms of heat stress or food security, in terms of water availability, in terms of how much water is available for farming. And on energy, it reduces the ability to create hydropower and potentially increases the damage that is caused by floods and so on. So disaster-related damage. And that collectively makes everything more difficult for whichever Afghan government is trying to manage the country in future. So it sort of adds these headwinds to an already difficult situation in terms of straining government services, potentially fueling competition between different groups over really valuable water resources, valuable land, and potentially undercutting the government's legitimacy if they are seen not to be able to provide basic services to people as a result, in part, of climate change.
So we're talking here about compound effects and the correlation between these two. In the second pathway, you say that more frequent droughts could boost the drug economy. Why is that? And what does that mean for the people in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I mean, this is potentially a really significant issue as well. I mean, Afghanistan already, to set the context, is a major producer of poppy, producing opium, which goes into heroin. In 2017, it was estimated that the opium trade was worth something between $4.1 and $6.6 billion. And actually, that's an amount that exceeds all of Afghanistan's legal exports. Now, poppy is a drought-resilient, relatively water-efficient crop, and the product of it, the opium paste that comes out of poppies, is easily transportable and is valuable. So where you have farmers who don't have access to water or who have reduced access to water, if they have a choice between perhaps growing wheat, which is one of the staple crops of the country, which is quite water-intensive, produces a crop that's heavy, difficult to transport, and producing poppies for opium, in the context of a government that's not able to really stop the spread of poppy cultivation, then you can see how these kind of impacts, less predictable rain, less availability of water, could really link to a further expansion of the drug economy in Afghanistan. And that is a major source of instability. It creates incentives for insurgent groups to keep the government out of areas, because otherwise the government comes in and tries to eradicate the poppy fields. It creates a direct conflict between the farmers and the government because they want to sort of protect their poppy fields. And it undermines, again, sort of government legitimacy and creates a conflict economy where people's means of subsistence, means of survival, revolves around creating an illegal product. And that, for the long term, for stability in Afghanistan, is really not a good thing.
Wow, that's a really interesting and dangerous linkage. I didn't know about it, to be honest. On top of all this, scarce water and arable land resources are often connected with an increase in community level and inter-ethnic conflict. Is this also true for Afghanistan?
Yeah, this is really true. And this kind of speaks to how we think about Afghanistan in the international community. I mean, when you look at stories about Afghanistan, the ones that grab the headlines are always Al-Qaeda attacks or Taliban attacks or Haqqani network attacks or government ambushes, whatever it might be, you know, drone strikes and so on. But actually, in terms of people's experience of conflict in communities on the ground, the majority of people in surveys that have been done are reporting violent conflict over land and over water rather than over necessarily militant attack or government reprisals or government militant battles. So people's experience of violent conflict tends to be community level conflict over valuable land and the water that gives that land its value as farming land. And you might remember in the beginning, I was talking about the fact that Afghanistan is an ethnically very diverse place, 40 different languages, 200 different dialects, very mountainous. So people have been quite isolated in different places. And so there's a very diverse patchwork of different groups coming from across Afghanistan. And there's also a sectarian divide between Shia Muslims and Sunni Muslims. And so these community conflicts get overlaid on this. And there's a long history of conflicts between Kuchi nomadic herders, for example, who are Sunni, and Hazara farmers who are Shia, over access to grazing land, over access to water, over access to arable land. And so you can sort of see how in this scenario where we're looking at potentially 3.5, 4, 5, maybe even 7 degrees of warming, And the impacts that has on the fertility of the land, the availability of irrigation water, and all of these impacts that climate change could bring, that could then get overlain on existing community tensions and just make those more difficult, more divisive, more tricky to resolve, and increase the community level tension in numerous ways. And that's one of the things I think that sits below the headlines that we're often aware of when we talk about Afghanistan, but is actually a really significant thing to bear in mind when we think about what is actually threatening people's daily lives.
The fourth pathway you identify concerns international tensions over transboundary water resources. What is the problem here, and how does it impact peace and stability in the country?
This comes back to the question of geography. You know, Afghanistan is a high landlocked country. It's what they call a water tower. It's where the rain falls and glaciers, the snowpack melts, and that feeds the rivers that flow out into its neighboring states. So it's surrounded by other countries, several of which are even more water insecure than Afghanistan is. Actually, on a per capita basis, Afghanistan has relatively high levels of water compared to its Central Asian neighbors, but it's just that water is not very well evenly divided across the country. So Pakistan, Iran, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Tajikistan all rely to a greater or lesser degree on the water that comes out of Afghanistan. Afghanistan is made up of five major watersheds, and all the major rivers, bar one in Afghanistan, flow out of its borders. And so it's had 40 years of war, and its ability to manage its water resources are much less developed than its neighbors. So it hasn't built the dams, it hasn't built the irrigation networks that perhaps you have in Uzbekistan and Pakistan and elsewhere. And so because this war has restricted the construction of this water-related infrastructure, it means that Afghanistan can use and retain less of this water. And that's sort of the benefit of its neighbors. So they've got a vested interest to see continued instability in Afghanistan, because that then potentially doesn't impede the amount of water they're going to get. And this sets up one of the dynamics that has been a real problem in Afghanistan for decades, which is it lives in a tough neighborhood. It is the source of a lot of competition between different countries over who has influence. So between Pakistan and India, between Russia and the international community, between the international community now and China, and so on. There's all these different proxy battles for influence that are being sort of fought out in Afghanistan. And that means that there's this dynamic where some of Afghanistan's neighbors have a vested interest in Afghanistan continuing to be underdeveloped and continuing not to invest in the water infrastructure that would allow it to use more of the water that it has within its territory. And that creates a dynamic where you have at least elements within those countries that are active peace spoilers. And we've seen this all around. So Iran, for example, there have been reports of Iran funding Taliban insurgents to attack water infrastructure, dams that are being built on rivers that would be flowing into Iran. So again, this is one of those things where, because Afghanistan is where a lot of the water comes from, it gives it a certain degree of influence over its neighbors, but it also creates this situation where the neighbors might want to sort of see Afghanistan not invest in its own water infrastructure. So it makes a tough neighborhood a bit tougher.
Very interesting to hear the geopolitical dynamics of the region. I think there's a general understanding about the crucial role that natural resources play in many conflict settings throughout the world, and the fact that climate pressures over these resources only make matters worse. But if there's one thing we learned with the regional risk briefs of the Climate Security Expert Network, and I think you've demonstrated that very well, is that the way these risks play out tend to be highly regionalized. Now, Afghanistan is rich in deposits of minerals used in renewable energy technology. Could this become a problem in the future?
Yeah, I mean, and like you said, this is the sort of fifth point that I laid out. And it's not happening yet, but it's one to bear in mind for future, which is that we're looking at this immense energy transition, potentially, if we're dealing with climate change, if we're moving away from fossil fuels, if we're moving towards electrification. We suddenly need to completely change the range of minerals that we're producing and using as a world community. And that will change the resource politics about where those minerals are found. Now, Afghanistan, as a result of the accident of its geography, has tremendously valuable minerals within it. Nobody's completely sure quite how much, but they've been valued at an estimate of between $1 and $3 trillion. And some of those minerals are potentially really important for the energy transition, particularly lithium. You know, Afghanistan was memorably called the Saudi Arabia of lithium. So it potentially has a lot of supplies of lithium and also copper. So there's a mine that is being 60 or 70 kilometers outside of Kabul called the Aynak mine, which has the world's second largest deposit of copper has been found. And it's been many years, it's been in the process of being developed. But it means that, again, Afghanistan could become the focus of a lot of attention for the mineral resources that it has, if it can harness those resources well in a way that doesn't create massive problems of pollution or local conflicts with the local communities, then perhaps that could be a really valuable source of revenue for Afghanistan. But at the same time, you know, there's a risk that these are minerals that could become conflict minerals or could add to the dynamics, be captured by particular groups, be the focus for fighting. And so we need to be really careful and really aware of how the politics in Afghanistan and around Afghanistan are developing with regard to these minerals and their potential extraction. In the best case scenario, these could be important resources for Afghanistan and important for the world in terms of helping with the energy transition, but there's real risks there as well.
Thank you so much for explaining all those interesting and certainly important pathways to us. The report goes beyond identifying the risks. It also recommends a number of entry points that the Afghan government should consider when responding to the evolving risks we just heard about. In your opinion, Ollie, what should, or better yet, what can the Afghan government do to address and avert the climate fragility risks in their country?
Yeah, I mean, there's a big difference between what they should do and what they can do. I mean, the Afghan government is in a tough situation. I mean, the first is almost the most important, is to improve water and land management. All of this comes back to how does Afghanistan manage its water, manage its land, manage disputes over that. And doing more with less, getting more out of its existing land, the sort of stuff that's easy to say and extremely hard to do, but improving water infrastructure, managing some of the competition over these resources, reducing losses of water and so on, will go a long way in terms of enhancing food security, creating jobs in rural areas, and sort of supporting the general ability of people to live in rural areas and across Afghanistan as well. That's the first thing. The second thing is really about understanding what's happening and sort of being able to monitor this complex interactions of climate change and with water, with land, with some of these other things so that you can inform appropriate responses. Again, as we were talking about before with minerals, what's happening with minerals trade, with demand for lithium and copper and so on, and how does that play into the politics inside Afghanistan? So that's the second thing. And the third thing is a really important one, but again, it's sort of difficult to see how it can be done, but is to involve Afghanistan's neighbors in joint action on climate change. What you ultimately want to try and do is to bring all of Afghanistan's neighbors to create an incentive for them to see peace, stability, development, growth in Afghanistan. Maybe the fact that they share common challenges over climate change, over the potential reductions in transboundary water, that might be something that could bring these groups together that historically have been, there's been a lot of distrust, and create a neighborhood that is more constructive for Afghanistan. So that's the third one. And, you know, maybe that water could be a sort of way of bringing those countries together. The fourth one, again, it's a tough one, but is, you know, at the moment, there are peace talks between the Taliban and the government. They are extremely difficult. They are being delayed. There's a lot at stake. It might be that there's some way of bringing some kind of climate change aspect into those peace talks. I must admit, it's not immediately obvious to me how that can be done, but it's, I think it's worth some people who are much closer to the politics of the negotiations than I am to think about what can be done in terms of, again, bringing different groups together, crossing that sectarian divide, crossing that ideological divide between effectively what has been a Western-backed government and what is an Islamist guerrilla movement. Are there any ways to bring them together over some of these issues of shared challenges, maybe not framed in the sense of climate change, but framed in the sense of water, land, farmers, livelihood, agriculture? And then the fifth one is around continuing support for Afghanistan. I mean, we were talking already about how Afghanistan is falling off the headlines with COVID-19 and with everything else that's happened. And there's a certain amount of fatigue of news of Afghanistan in the 20 or so years that the international community has been there since 9/11. But the problems haven't gone away. And so Afghanistan is going to need support. The Afghan people need and deserve our support. And part of what they need a lot of support to do is to adapt to climate change. I mean, Afghans, on a per capita basis, produce a third of the global average in terms of greenhouse gases per person. But they are potentially going to suffer quite significantly from climate change. So just as a moral point, as a self-interested point for regional security, it's really important the international community doesn't forget about Afghanistan, even if all the international troops are withdrawn. There's a real risk of the whole country falling back into civil war. If that happened, then so much progress that has happened over the last 20 years would be undone.
From experience, and I think you already touched upon this before, we all know that, especially in fragile states, legitimacy of the government is often in question. Is there any of the entry points you just described the Afghan government should prioritize? And if yes, why?
That's a good question. I mean, I would say all of these. I mean, ultimately, it has to be what is possible. And the Afghan government is extremely constrained. The two I think that I would pick out as perhaps being the most possible for some kind of action now is really improving water and land management is the first one. And then just seeing if there's any scope for joint action on climate change, water, with the neighbours around Afghanistan. So those two, if you can do more with less in terms of the land you have and the water you have internally, and bring in supporters and help create an incentive for a peaceful Afghanistan by bringing those neighbouring countries into some kind of common agreement about how to tackle some of these challenges, I think those would be two things that are worth really focusing on.
Well, it's great to hear not just of the risks, but also of the opportunities available for addressing these risks. In this light, what role would you say the UN and other foreign actors such as NATO or the American mission play, or let's say can play, in addressing climate fragility risks in Afghanistan?
It's a really good question, and it's really in flux, frankly, because like I was saying, you know, there's the potential of the full drawdown of international troops next month, May. I mean, we'll have to see whether that happens. There will continue to be some international organizations there. But again, it just really depends on what the context is. International forces have played a role in terms of trying to support community development and so on as part of their hearts and minds counterinsurgency strategy, which involved really army lieutenants walking around with briefcases full of cash, splashing a lot of money around in rural areas to try and bring local communities around to sort of seeing the benefits of peace and stability. And there's a lot that can be talked about with that. The international forces, NATO, I think whatever happens, are going to be much less prominent in the next 20 years than they've been in the last 20 years, for example. The UN will be there in some form. I mean, what the UN would like to see itself as is an overall facilitator of peace, bringing together the different groups, trying to mediate between these very different visions for the future of Afghanistan, integrating the Sustainable Development Goals, providing expertise on a lot of these things we were talking about, water, land management, and so on. So there's a whole series of things that the international community could do. The big question is, what will they do and what will the context in which they'll operate be in future?
So we heard many news in 2020 about a peace deal between the Afghan government and the Taliban. How does the situation look like today?
Yeah, I mean, this is the big question, and I'm afraid I don't have any real insights. There are a lot of people who know a lot more about this than I do. What broadly happened is February 2020, there was a ceasefire, effectively. I wouldn't call it a peace deal, between the Taliban and America, effectively, where they came to some kind of common understanding where on the one side, the US said we'll pull out international troops by 1st of May 2021 in return for basically the Taliban committing not to allow Afghanistan as a base to launch attacks on America or NATO countries, and also a commitment on the Taliban to enter into peace talks with the Afghan government. Those peace talks were much delayed. They started in September of 2020. And they're still ongoing. It's extremely difficult. There's a long way between different groups. And depending on who you speak to, there's certain degrees of optimism or pessimism as to what's going to happen. On the one side, the Afghan government is under pressure to enter into some kind of power sharing agreement with the Taliban. But they're saying, look, we're a democratically elected government. Why would we share power with an insurgent group? On the other, the Taliban are saying, well, effectively, we've militarily won this. Our major enemy has committed to leave. Let's hang tight, not say too much, wait till they go, and then we take over and we don't have to share power with anybody. And frankly, nobody knows the real result of this. And this, I think, is a really important point to make in the context of climate security, which is, I mean, frankly, we've talked about some potentially quite serious impacts of climate change in Afghanistan, but in the short term, climate change is not going to determine the peace and security of Afghanistan. It is a minor issue compared to what happens with a potential civil war between the government and the Taliban, between what happens with international troops, between the level of sectarian ethnic tension in Afghanistan, and what happens with the neighbors around Afghanistan. So we need to be really careful not to overemphasize climate change as a driver of insecurity in Afghanistan, because frankly, if you are in Afghan government, you wake up with perhaps the longest list of security threats of any government in the world to deal with. So when we're talking about climate change, we're talking about, you know, these are issues that potentially are going to be there for decades, that, like we were saying, create headwinds that make potentially peace, stability, recovery in Afghanistan more difficult. These are things that need to be borne in mind by the international community and the Afghan government. But certainly in the short term, they're not going to be determinants of whether Afghanistan is at peace or at war.
I'm also curious to hear your opinion on possible changes with regard to the new US administration and Donald Trump's decision from last year to reduce American troops. Do you expect any changes?
Yeah, I mean, this is the big question. The original deadline was to remove troops by 1st of May. There's already been massive reductions from the peak of troop numbers, more than 100,000 international troops in Afghanistan. The Biden administration has inherited a commitment that it may not be comfortable with, and we'll have to see what happens with that. Like I said, there's people who are much more familiar with the sort of latest twists and turns of this than I am. But my own sense, and this is just a personal opinion, is that if we see a full drawdown of troops, I'm afraid we're very likely to see an increase in violence and potentially the possible capture of Kabul and the emergence of a Taliban administration within months or years. And so there's a real risk as Afghanistan falls off international headlines, it goes into an even more difficult situation. And that really is the concern over the next few years. And clearly the US occupation and the international forces engagement in Afghanistan hasn't delivered stability and peace in Afghanistan. So something has to change. But also full withdrawal just feels like a very dangerous situation for the country to be in.
There's so much to be said about Afghanistan and how a changing climate plays into the country's multiple vulnerabilities. And time is flying by, and unfortunately, we have to come to an end today. To summarize, we heard that impacts of climate change threaten livelihoods, increase community level and inter-ethnic conflicts, worsen poverty, weaken governance, and boost the drug economy in Afghanistan. I think this last one is perhaps the most surprising one. We also learned that those threats are not inevitable. They can be addressed and averted if the right measures and policies are put in place. Our guest, Ollie Brown, author of the Climate Fragility Risk Brief on Afghanistan for the Climate Security Expert Network, suggested 5 concrete entry points to do so. These are improving water and land management, developing data monitoring, strengthening regional cooperation, bringing the environment into peace negotiations, and building climate security into the UN's mandate in Afghanistan. That's a very important one.
Thank you so much, Ollie, for sharing your insights and expertise with us. I think this was a very rich and interesting conversation, and climate security in Afghanistan is certainly an important topic to speak about. Our listeners can download the risk brief via the link in this episode's description. We will be back with another episode of the Climate Diplomacy Podcast in a few weeks. Meanwhile, you can reach us with questions and feedback on Twitter @ClimateDiplo. Thank you for tuning in. Until next time, goodbye.